I'm your host, Dúlta Dougherty, and today's guest is Catriona Hutchison O'Neill, the founder of Join Talent. Catriona had a really successful career in talent acquisition and the strategic element of that, managing massive teams for blue chip clients over the years. She saw a gap in the market and has gone and found out a way to make RPO more accessible and better, and her company is scaling and she's getting the results that she dreamed of. Really inspirational person. And I was lucky enough to actually come across her in my first time I've ever publicly spoke. She came on the stage beforehand and I remember being like, oh no, I can't speak like that. So no surprise she's gone on to bigger and better things since joining her firm or since launching her company. We talked about the events world a little bit, and you know, because she would have traveled around with the usual suspects into doing different HR tech events, and now that she's on the other side of the fence, i.e. selling to the clients, not being the spokesperson for the clients, she hasn't been invited to as many events to be a speaker, which I thought was interesting. I was kind of a little surprised by that, but we went into that in a bit of detail. She also just has a great insight into the industry in general, whether that's agency recruitment or internal recruitment and how the whole thing works together. And I think her business is probably one to watch over the next while. You know, we're coaching lots of startup recruitment entrepreneurs, and a lot of them do dream about getting into a point where they can get recurring revenue into their business. And she's done that from day one, took all the credibility that she's built over the years, partnered with the right people, got the right offering. And yeah, it's just super impressive. Hope you guys enjoy this one. Definitely one to watch.
And I'm joined today by Catriona from Join Talent. How are you today?
All good, thank you. Good. Chilly, but good.
Chilly, where am I calling at the moment?
Really far nosebleed north, so up in Brechin in Scotland.
Wow, that's probably the only time we're going to do that on this podcast.
Yeah, there's not a massive like TA community. I have moved up the road from Adam Gordon, who runs Canada ID, who used to be my almost next door neighbour, but I've moved up the road away from him now.
All right.
Not specifically to get away from Adam, just to move up the road.
And is there seems to be a bit of a HR tech and rec tech out of Glasgow.
I think Glasgow's got really trendy, hasn't it? So it's got, in the last sort of 5-10 years, Glasgow's got really fashionable and a bit gentrified, a bit of a hub for tech investment and stuff. They've got a couple of good incubators there. So I think it's probably the same for most industries. There's a lot of good tech there.
And give us the elevator pitch, Catriona. What do you do?
I've gone dark side a couple of years ago. So having run big in-house TA functions for a long, long time, myself and my co-founder set up Join Talent back at the very back end of 2018.
Yeah.
Two things to what we do. One side, really simple, which is management consultancy in the talent acquisition space. So change management strategy. And then the other side is embedded talent solutions, / boutique RPO, whichever your preferred poison is, whichever way you call it, which we've got a little bit of tech that sits in the back of that, but it's predominantly a service proposition. It's pretty good. It's a good space to be in at the minute.
You know, the first time I ever spoke publicly, you were speaking and and it terrified me.
Oh God, no, what did I do and where was it?
Well, you're a professional speaker, and I think it was on Louise Trianz's Inspire. I think it was you.
Was that the one where I had to get there on a motorbike? Was that?
You talked about data, and yeah. And everybody else was a beginner speaker, including me. I talked about our VA solution or the 4-hour work week or something like that. And And everybody was looking at me like, who is it? What is he even on about? And of course, and you come in before with this polished, like, and I'm like, it was like speaking like at a Microsoft event. And I remember thinking, oh no, this isn't good. Why did they have her?
It wasn't intended, honestly. So that particular event, I'd been accidentally double booked, and I was speaking at an event in, I think it was Frankfurt or Berlin that afternoon. And so I had to fly. This sounds all very like hipster, but it really isn't that glamorous. So I had to fly back in. I never like to let anyone down. Fly back into London City Airport. And the only way I could get there on time to make it work with the flights was instead of booking a taxi, I had to book a guy on a motorbike. So I had to like jump on and get off the plane in London City, jump on the back of the motorbike, strap my case to the back of it, and held on to him. I managed to get from London City Airport right into the city centre in like 10 minutes tops. It was awesome. It was the only way to get there. So that was all a bit stressed that night.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure it stressed me and the rest of the rookies out watching.
Not at all. Well, that's a funny thing, though. I think, and that's how you and me kind of got connected, chatting in social groups, that before, like in my before setting up Joint Talent days, I used to literally travel around the world getting asked to speak at events. And you had to really curtail the number of events that you said yes to, because otherwise you'd never get any work done. And then I set up JT and, you know, got even broader experience, because you learn new stuff every day. Like at any one point, I'm working with 15 to 20 clients across multiple different sectors. I think we added up the other day that, and this is a few weeks old now, that already by the beginning of March, we, across our team, we'd spoken to 35,000 candidates across 16 countries. Wow. So the amount of insight that you have, but then all of a sudden, nobody ever wants to talk to you anymore because you're vendor side. And I'm like, I literally have never known as much as I know today.
Yeah.
But nobody wants to, and you've got a really different perspective, but they don't want to talk to you as much. Apart from Andrea Kirby in Australia, she'll always have you. She's good.
So walk me through with that. It's like, how did you, like, so you didn't just start speaking to like massive rooms, did you? Did you build up to it? Were you paid for speaking events, or how does
I've been paid for some speaking events. That was never why I did it. I really love talking about TA. I could talk about it all day long. I also quite like traveling. So if it came with a, we'll pay your flights to come out, and I could fit it into my schedule, I'd probably do it. And it's great. Like I got to go to Australia just before COVID, and I got to take my little one, who was nearly seven, with me, and she got to come on a big work trip, and you know, stuff like that's really cool. But yeah, no, I probably did go straight in talking to bigger rooms, to be fair. But I did a lot of that when I was a kid as well. I was a bit of a weird teenager, did a lot of public speaking and stuff. So that's never fazed me. I could stand up on a stage in front of 5,000 people and it wouldn't faze me at all.
Would you even need to prep at this stage?
I don't like prepping, and that's why whenever you do some of the really big events like CIPD annual events and stuff, they work with really professional teams who want to make sure that you're not going to embarrass them in front of 2,000 people or something. So they make you do sessions like this. They'll get you on a Zoom and they want to do a dry run through your talk and stuff. And I'm like, geez, like, I don't know. I've got like four slides and I'll stand up and talk to them. But the nuance that I give you this time will be slightly different to the way I talk about it next time, because you're reading the room when you're talking as well.
You're the Billy Connolly of TA.
Just I swear a lot.
Yeah.
We've got bad hair.
Yeah, because he invented it on the spot. Everybody else has a pre-recorded script.
Yeah, but you've got to read the room, and every room is different. Like I remember standing on a stage up in, it was in Scotland actually. And I'll not say the name of the event because that's not fair, but it was an event that I was speaking at with an industry peer. And he was quite rehearsed. He liked to be quite rehearsed. And his little bit was first, then it was me, and it's back to him. And as soon as he started speaking, you got the sense of this room is not in the same page as we are. They're just not on the same page. Like reverse, reverse, reverse. You really got to think about how we position this talk. But when you're scripted, you can't do that. When you're not scripted, you can a bit. We still, like, he swore a couple of times, which I'd already read the room to go, like, abort. Do not be swearing at this room.
How did you fix it in real time?
You just have to spin on your heel in terms of the way that you're pitching your conversation, what level you're going in at. So you could see really quickly that there's no point in going deep TA on this one and using loads of acronyms. They weren't going to get it. So I brought that one up a lot of levels and stopped swearing, and it kind of worked. We got through it okay.
And when you're talking about it now, because it's not like you turned into a bad speaker overnight, but you're not getting the same invites because you're on vendor site.
Yeah, that's all that's happened. Yeah.
What's the, for anybody that's listening that hasn't been through that at the higher echelons, like, what, why is that?
I think it's a lot of different things. I think people assume that if you've gone vendor side, number one, you're going to come in and just pitch what you do and do a sales pitch. And I'm like, I don't even do that when I'm selling our business, for goodness sake. Like, it's not, you know, that's not the way you're set up. And I think also there's a little bit of institutionalized snobbery in the industry as well, of the, if somebody can't see that you are a 100% pure play practitioner, somehow the commercial slant that you may have because of your business makes your judgment less valued or something, which is crazy when you sit on this side of it and you're like, well, no, actually, instead of having a perspective that represents the experience that you're getting from one company as an in-house employee, I can talk about, you know, 20, 30 different companies' perspectives.
And
I can talk about that, yeah, across different countries, different regions, with different problems, different challenges, different opportunities. It's so much richer. And it's not that one's better than the other. Like, it's, you know, they're equally valuable to get, but I don't think you should be precluding one set of views just because somebody is vendor side.
Well, what was the moment that you went from being an employee to going, I'm going to be an entrepreneur?
It was a really bad interview. So I was getting to the end of my stint where I was director of TA at Nationwide. And what was killing me there was it was 400 odd miles from my house. So I was doing like an 800 mile drive every week, like there and back 400 miles. It was killing me a bit. And I got to the end of 2.5 years, landed what I wanted to land, started to think about what's next. And I got tapped on the shoulder. I'll not say the name of the company, but I got tapped on the shoulder by a really big brand who were in the, like, only the two or three brands I would have thought of working for next. Went along for a coffee chat with the person who would have been my boss, and it was awful. They were awful in the first instance. They were awful, awful. Couldn't have worked for them in a million years. Didn't understand TA at all. But when I came out of it, I remember sitting in my car outside their offices and I felt really down in the dumps. And I was trying to unpack that, and why do I feel this way? And taking that person out of the equation and not wanting to work for that individual, I was like, do you know what really is getting me is that I could sit here with a bit of paper, and if I took that job tomorrow, I could write out as one of the biggest jobs in the region, I could still write out in a bit of paper exactly what the next 2 years of my life would look like and every single thing I would do. I'm like, is that what I'm going to do? I'm just going to do rinse and repeat for the next like 20 years until I retire. And I think that was it was a major epiphany for me. But starting a business is hard. Like it's, you know, as a main wage earner in the house and stuff as well, it's a big, big old decision to leave the comfort blanket of the big corporate salary and everything that comes with it.
And put your ego on the line.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, because you're very exposed. And it was really weird. I almost had to deprogram myself. Like the first 3 or 4 months when it was just really me. Like even something like you used to take the cat to the vet and you felt like you were playing hooky or skipping school or something like that, that you should be like letting someone know. Because even as a senior person in corporate land, you're still accountable to other people. Yeah. You just honestly had to deprogram yourself.
How did you find your co-founder?
It's very freeing.
How did you find your co-founder?
So Kevin and I have knew each other through the industry for several years. We met through the RL100, through Jamie Leonard and the RL100. Just through that network and shared many of the same views about the issues of the industry. And he really wanted to do something more in the entrepreneurial space. I'd made a bit of a head start with Joint Talents. I think I was about 7 or 8 months in by that point. And so it was just at the point where we get some of the basic infrastructure and case studies and having two engines to the plane is infinitely better than one. So just that network.
What does his engine do and what does yours?
So Kevin is much more in the enablement space. So very much looking at the tech stack, the enablement for the service proposition. So how do we do what we're doing? That's his side of it. I'm much more interested in the actual service proposition and the management consultancy side of the business and running the business. He doesn't want to be the CEO. No desire to do that. No desire to what he would call operationally run the business, which I always laugh when he said, I'm like, just operationally run the business. He's no desire to do that. He really, really wants to get into the kind of more commercial side and the tech side.
And what those early days, you had your plan. Has that evolved since? Has there been any like major pivots, or did you figure out from day one what the vision was?
I think there's definitely been, I don't know if they call them pivots or enhancements along the way. So the pure play, very, very much day one, was let's get going with the management consultancy side. The embedded talent solutions came in about 3-4 months later. And that's the bit that then's really grown quickly. But even that proposition is constantly shifting. So, you know, we always had sourcing in there as a model, so a pure play sourcing model. But it's only really since COVID and since specifically really kind of Q4 last year that the demand for that has really astronomically increased to the point that we've got, instead of sourcers being in as a support underneath the teams that we're putting into businesses, there is a couple of clients where we've just got teams of sourcers with like a manager sitting on top of them. And that's a really different proposition. So instead of doing a 360 degree job with your own sourcing support, you're providing sourcers in who are supporting their 360 degree recruiters. So things like that, you know, it was opportunistic in a way, but it was more, our clients pulled us towards that model. They wanted that. So we looked at it and figured out how to do it well for them.
Let's jump into the HR tech side. You've had quite a few years experience working out how to best go about putting in the best software. How does that conversation normally go with new startups when they say to you, day one, how can I do this without fucking everything up?
So if you're a day one startup, it always depends on what day two, day three, and day 300 are going to look for you, right? Like if you're a day one, you know, one client that we're working with at the minute who is our kind of smallest client in terms of the earliest stage of their growth scale up. They've got 3 people working there today and they're going to be 30 by the end of this year. And probably by the end of 2 years, they might be about 50 or 60, but they're not going to be 5,000 or 6,000, right? So what is it that they're, and also they're regulated. So they're in a financial services, fintech regulated space. So you've got to think about what are the components of the solution that they're going to need that will be scalable for the next 2 to 3 years without building infrastructure that they just don't need. Because to any scale up where you start building a couple of levels too high, all you're doing is you're reducing agility and creating extra costs that you don't need. So what I'd recommend to that organization in terms of their tech stack for TA or even for HR would be really different to if I go into one of our multinational clients that's hiring 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 people a year. because they've probably got quite a sophisticated tech stack already, and what you're doing there is almost suggesting point solutions to help them optimize what they're doing today or where they've got a gap. So it's really different. But the one thing I would say is get an ATS.
Yeah.
You might be surprised. I don't know if you would be or not, but you might be surprised by the number of organizations we go into that are recruiting reasonable numbers, like, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50, 100 a year, but still don't have an ATS. Because the common thing I get told is, oh, we're not big enough for that, or we can't afford that. I'm like, I can get you one for free. Like, you can get one for no pennies. If you don't need much functionality, there are literally free play solutions out there if that's what you're worried about. There's no excuse to not have an ATS with all of the risk that comes with not having one.
And you have a data, so what do? You go get a load of data and put that into the system, or how?
No, to be honest, unless you are in a regulated industry, there's not really any need to start porting data across into an ATS or something like that. Like, you know, what are you going to do with it? Mm. The only reason you would do it is if you needed some kind of historical reporting on hiring for a third party. Like if you're in Northern Ireland, for example, and you have to do equal opportunities reporting, probably makes sense to import some of that data into your ATS if you're not using one already, because otherwise the Equality Commission are going to come and have a bit of a word with you. But yeah, from an ATS perspective, no. I know that the other one that you're probably getting at is, but what about companies that are using a lot in the CRM space and building up their talent pools? And I think, you know, from social, I've got some strong opinions on that one. I think there are some organizations and some industries who definitely do need to invest in building out talent pools, because the types of roles that they're hiring for, they're either always on recruitment, or they're so specialist in nature that you've really got to build up a relationship with your target candidates over a long period of time for whenever you need them. But for the majority of companies, my personal view is that the job market moves too fast. Like if you build up a talent pool today, like by tomorrow, you've just got a big stagnant bucket of water growing algae. Because most of those people within a couple of weeks will have moved on to jobs and they're not looking at the job market again for another 1, 2, maybe even 3 years. And it always seems crazy to me that people still think that's a good idea and almost what a pat on the back for. I've got 10,000 people in my talent pool. And I look at that and I'm like, geez, you must have not got enough work to do. Like if you've got time to fanny about with 10,000 people, probably of which 9,990 are of no use to you, otherwise they would already be in jobs at the minute that you're advertising, you probably need a bit more work to do.
What are the big issues that people are trying to solve out there?
So I think the big issue today is, how do you find and engage candidates? So you know, that's the number one issue across every single client that we work with, is literally, how do you find the right people? Two different aspects to that. One is for higher volume type recruitment or lower skilled recruitment, how do we get the right people whenever, for certain roles, we're going to put an advert out there? And if we put an advert out, we're going to get 400 applications, and then that's going to kill somebody in my team for 2 weeks working through those applications. How do you pick the right person out of those 400 people? Mm. Is one side of the coin. The other side of the coin, which is the one that we more commonly get involved in the conversation on, is, how do I find the right people when everybody else is looking for the same people? So, you know, I need a full stack engineer. Well, so does everybody else. So how do I stand out in an increasingly globalized, fully remote job market? You know, I'm sitting here in, you know, Glasgow, and all of a sudden I've got companies from London and Paris and San Francisco and New York all poaching in my talent out of my talent pools when they weren't doing that six months ago, because I'm in Glasgow and they're paying 20 grand more. So that's the two things. How do I find the right people? How do I engage them? And how do I tell my story and get them interested in the right way?
So I suppose I don't have your eyes on the marketplace like that, but is can you give us a bit more insight into how the market's changed since COVID in terms of that?
It's completely different now. So if I focus probably more on tech, because I think it's the bit that's changed the most, but it's also the bit that I think won't bounce back to anything like where it was before. So as I said before, like since the beginning of this year, we've added up across joint talent, across all of the clients we work for. By the start of March, we'd spoken to over 35,000 candidates across 16 countries, which is insane. I know when I added it, I couldn't believe that it was that many. So we've got pretty decent insights, it's fair to say. I think there's a few fallacies around at the minute. So one of them is companies believing that, a bit like the CEO of Goldman Sachs, you know, the guy that came out 2 weeks ago and was like, well, at the end of COVID, we're all going straight back to no remote working whatsoever, and that's the way it's going to be. And you might get away with that if you're Goldman Sachs, that's fine. You're probably not going to get away with that if you're a 50 strong scale up in Manchester, because the candidate market says you're not going to get away with it. So 61% of candidates now are telling us in the tech space they're only interested in even having a conversation about a job if it's remote only. They're not interested in semi-remote, going to be in the office one day a week or one day a quarter. It's got to be fully remote or they're not interested.
What once we have them into our business, what challenges does that now face, and what is technology doing to solve it?
Well, there's a whole bit around the practical side in terms of line manager capability. That was always the barriers to remote working before COVID, right? Our hiring managers can't manage people remotely. They can only do line of sight management. And they've had to get past that now, which is positive, I think. From a technology perspective, you've got all of the challenges around your communication channels, almost like it's the antithesis of what internal comms and HR would have said to you before COVID, right? Don't be using, you know, internal communication channels for banter or casual chat, because that's never going to lead to good things. Yeah. Whereas now it's like, could you please use them for casual chat? Because that's now your water cooler conversation. And how do you manage and regulate that?
I hadn't thought of it like that.
Yeah, but we think that's what you always got told, right? It's like, there'll be no banter on the team WhatsApp, thank you very much. And now if you don't have the banter in the team WhatsApp group, within dignity at work guidelines, of course, where do you have that, right? It's really difficult. We've always been remote first, so for us this is just normal anyway. But I think that's one side of it. There's also the enablement piece in terms of access to the tools that you need. For some companies, that's really easy. For a lot of companies, nearly everything that you're doing is SaaS or on the cloud and you're fine. It's not the case for everybody. So if you are doing stuff that requires you to be working on platforms that are, you know, highly sensitive, or you need special portal access to, you know, having to ship laptops around the place is a pain, apart from anything else. We even have that with some of our clients that, you know, our recruiters have to work on their machines to be able to access their systems. So you've got a bunch of remote recruiters and the clients having to ship them all laptops because that's their policy. And fair play, if that's your policy, you know, that's fair enough. But it's unusual, like in today's world, that's still how a lot of the systems are set up for security reasons. So I think that's a big part of the challenge for companies is how do you get past that and become truly digital and global? Yeah. There's the other piece around collaboration. You know, how do you run agile sprints and how do you make sure that people get to collaborate in the right way, et cetera, if you're working remotely? But again, people have been doing it for a year. So if you've managed to successfully run and maybe even grow your business for a year remotely, sure, there are some things that are harder, but there's a bunch of things that are more positive as well in terms of access to talent. That's a pretty decent trade-off for it.
The issues that COVID has presented and these challenges, it's created a lot of innovation. The last time I spoke to you, you mentioned that there is a lot of innovation, but some of the issues are that people are trying to just solve one little problem. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
My old drum that I always bang. Yeah. So I think that's not a COVID inspired issue at all. I think that predates COVID by several years. And it's much more a product of the VC and the PE culture. So how companies get their funding through venture capitalists or private equity. What you tend to get when you speak to anybody who's got the kind of funding pockets is they're looking for solutions that solve a very niche specific problem, because that's something that they can see how to get a better multiplier on. You fix that one problem, you're the only person that fixes that one problem, but you're also, because you're fixing one problem, you can spin in the product development cycle much more quickly than if you're trying to boil the ocean. So I totally get it from one perspective, but what you've then got, if you look at the entire end-to-end talent acquisition journey, is an absolute plethora of point solutions, because that's what people are getting encouraged. Exactly. People are getting encouraged to go, you go fix this one, you go fix the problem of how does a candidate schedule themselves in for an interview. And then somebody else, you go fix the problem of how do you do pre-recorded video interviews. Somebody else, you go and fix the problem of how do you do a live video interview. Somebody else, you go fix the problem of how do you do a transcript of a video interview. Somebody else, go fix the problem of how do you do D&I level analysis of the transcript of a video interview. And you're like, Jesus, what? I've now got to have six different tools to be able to have an end-to-end solution for one centimeter of my process. And that's kind of where you get to, you know, like even something as simple as writing a job ad. You know, ATSs have, they've created the facility, which is great for you to then be able to do what you used to have to do manually, which is go and post it on pretty much every single job board. If you're into posting ads, fine. But then you've got separate solutions that have been developed around how do you analyze that job ad in terms of, you know, is it too masculine or too feminine, the way that you've written it, depending on the role, et cetera. You've got another one that will then look at analyzing it in terms of its employer branding impact. Like,
it's a lot. Then there's the testing, and then there's...
Yeah, and then you've got the channel management and analysis. You've got another tool on top of it to look at what's happening in each of your channels once you've sent out those adverts, and dialing up or dialing down your spend if you're doing PPC. And
In 10 years time, will they look back and be like, I cannot believe that you had to do 100 things. Now we just press a button and it all just speaks to each other.
Yeah, well, I think absolutely that's kind of where it's going to go. And I think someone like, you know, Smart Recruiters is a great example where they're effectively building almost like the equivalent of the app store for recruitment. So, you know, you buy their, if their solution is effectively the app store and that's what you're buying, and you can then go and pick one of a several hundred, if not several thousand. I think you've got Matt Charney coming on to have a chat with that anyway, but I love that concept. It's a really, really good concept, particularly if you're like I was, or like my co-founder was, heading up recruitment in a big corporate. Anything that's got to do with data is a nightmare to get through procurement. So if I can go and I can sign up to effectively almost an app store-esque like aggregator that allows me to pay one invoice, go through procurement, go through information security once, and pay a single consolidated invoice and not have to go through seven circles of hell with procurement and security and pen testing.
I didn't know that.
15 to 20, 30 different solutions, winner, winner every time.
Oh, big time, right?
Oh, 100%. Because that's, you know, something as simple as bringing in a new assessment tool, even wanting to trial a new assessment tool in a corporate environment. That's easily a 6-month project. I'm going to have to put somebody on that full time for 6 months just to see that process through to get us to the point that we can run a pilot on that tool. Because you're using candidate data, you've got to prove that it doesn't have bias. You've got to show what's happening in terms of data processing and yada, yada, yada.
Wow.
You then got to look at how does that connect back into whatever else you're using in terms of your tech stack. So that's straight away, I want to do a little bit of quick innovation. I've got a problem over here to solve. Maybe I'm getting too many applications for a role. I want to whack an assessment on the top of it. There's a 6-month commitment for somebody and all the costs, because that's going to cost me 25, 30 grand minimum to go and do that, versus if I'm using a solution that has a multitude of different assessments built into it, I can just go in and test it. You know, throw a few thousand behind it, go in, test it, leave it behind if it doesn't work. It's that whole test and learn cycle becomes easier.
So you've mentioned smart recruiters. Gone to your head now. You can only choose one technology per every big problem out there.
Oh, for goodness sake.
Throw a couple of people out at me who've impressed you, or companies that you think are innovating the world of HR tech.
There's not that much out there that massively, massively, massively impresses me, because nobody is truly solving the problem of how do you really bring this together in a cohesive fashion. I'm going to be a little bit sneaky and kind of go, I think the stuff that we're building in the back end to solve the sourcing problem is really good, because it's genuinely solving like the biggest problem that we have at the minute, which is how do you interrogate the live active directory of all the structured and unstructured data sources out there, particularly as more and more tech candidates are coming off LinkedIn. I guess probably LinkedIn, to be honest, in a way. Weirdly, even though they're the bad guys, right? But if you think about what they've done, it's literally transformed our entire industry, like literally transformed it. Like, I'm old enough to remember what the world was like before LinkedIn, whenever we had a filing cabinet full of CVs. And it's probably, I bet you nobody else has ever said LinkedIn on this podcast, because it's not a popular answer. But if you think about it, it's the single biggest piece of transformational technology that our industry has ever seen.
Why couldn't they get their ATS off the ground?
I don't know, to be honest. I never even looked at it myself. So I honestly don't know. I don't know how they were pricing it even.
If they were to buy smart recruiters, would that be a scary proposition?
I don't know. Possibly, only because the prices might go through the roof. That's kind of the challenge with LinkedIn, isn't it? Like, single-handedly, it's the best, single biggest and best development that the concept of talent acquisition has ever seen in our history.
Yeah.
But equally, you've now got a monopolized market with a brand who arbitrarily not only sets their own crazy prices, but arbitrarily sets rules and, you know, stops people from actually, like, how crazy is it that we've got one piece of technology where they can arbitrarily decide to put you in LinkedIn jail and instantly you can lose your livelihood overnight?
Yeah.
But they have the power to do that. That's crazy. Like, I can't think of any other industry that would be like that.
Yeah. So last question. You've purchased so much technology over the years, or been responsible for that. I wonder what the total sum of spend would have been that you've signed off over the years.
Like, I have no idea.
That'd be an interesting one to work out, wouldn't it?
It would be a lot. It'd be a lot.
Like, yeah. What are we talking in the?
Oh, probably tens of millions.
Tens of millions, right? So I think that qualifies you to answer the next question pretty well. If somebody does think they figured something out and they go get a bit of money and they start selling it and they try and sell it to you, how should they go about, or somebody like you who has the keys, how should they, like, what mistakes can they avoid? What advice would you give any tech founder?
So I think a couple of the best examples and companies that we do a lot of work with, because their bits of tech individually are really good. Companies like Brick and Resumo do a really good job on this. They have a really consultative approach. So they come in and with an approach of, we've built this because we're solving this problem. We're quite clear about, you know, what it is we're doing. That's fine. But we've probably not got it all right. So can you have a look at it? Tell us what you like and tell us if there's stuff you think you need us to fix. And if we can, we'll go away and fix it and try and work on something that works for you. That's a great approach. What's never a good approach is to send in some kind of really wet behind the ears junior salesperson. And I've had this, oh my God, it's like mortifying at times, but I've had this before where you get somebody coming in. My favorite one, I don't know if I should say the name of the brand actually, because that's a bit mean. My favorite one was,
go on.
It was an A, no, oh, no, that's really mean, but it was an ATS solution. Well, this will probably give it away without me confirming or denying, but it's an ATS solution. And the salesperson was this really lovely lady in Greece who was sitting, and we're putting this into a client. And so I joined the call, and she was explaining to the client how their ATS solution worked. And she was sharing on Zoom, she was sharing her lovely little presentation that she did talking about the ATS, where she was speaking very, very slowly and constantly doing the checking for buying signals. But we'd already agreed to bloody buy the thing, right? It's $5,000 spend, right? I'm like, we're past that point. You don't need to go, wouldn't this be useful? Couldn't you imagine if you used it like this or like that? But my favorite bit was she'd left her bloody speaker notes on the bottom. So it was even stuff like the client said, she said to the client, so tell me about your current challenges with talent acquisition. And the client said, blah, 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 blah. And then it came up with her being bottom. Oh, that sounds interesting. It must be very challenging. Don't send a junior person in who's never been a practitioner, who doesn't deeply understand the problem that they're trying to fix. And I think, you and I have chatted about this before. A lot of the HR and particularly the TA tech is built by people who've had a really, really bloody good idea about a particular problem, but they've never been a practitioner. Mm. They've maybe never even worked in TA in any capacity whatsoever. And they don't necessarily they've had a great idea, but don't necessarily understand how to solve for the problem that they're trying to solve. So they create something that's maybe 70% of the way there, but the missing 30% is the bit of, but you've got an idea in your head about how a TA process works, and that's not it. That's not how it actually works in real life. So getting people who have actually been practitioners, not just professional advisors, but people who actually would be using this stuff, in to help you understand how that would work in real life is really beneficial as well.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Katrina. Loads to digest there. Great chat to you, and hopefully we'll have you on again soon.
Excellent. Thank you.